From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yemen has a long history of war and strife, bristling with tribal and political divisions and weapons, a lot of them American right now. But in a world of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Yemen's problems are the world's problems. The Obama administration touted its policy of drones and light footprint U.S. special forces as the right way to wage war on terror. Now the U.S. embassy in Yemen is evacuated, and this weekend, U.S. special forces left in a hurry with Al-Qaeda on their doorstep. This hour on Point, Yemen in free fall, and maybe U.S. counter-terror plans in trouble, too. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is the lesson of Yemen? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Dubai is Noah Browning, Middle East correspondent for Reuters, formerly based in Yemen. Noah, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
The United Nations Security Council is saying, stop, stop, cut it out, don't do this. Is that having any impact on the ground in Yemen?
It's having no impact at all. Yemen is one of the most heavily armed countries in the world, and its struggle right now is a kind of zero-sum game between some very bitter rivals who are determined to win the country for themselves.
You've got a strongman president who was kicked out a couple of years ago, Saleh. Then you've got the president who was kicked out by the Houthis just a few months ago. Is this a battle between them, wrapped up in Houthi and Al-Qaeda and ISIS, or is it a battle between, is it a proxy war between Saudi Arabia backing one side and Iran another side, or is it a terrorist war, if you will, between Al-Qaeda and ISIS?
On some level, it's all of those things. Yemen's a very complex country. It's one of the poorest countries in the Arab world. It's one of the most fractious in terms of it having a kaleidoscope of different rival armed groups inside it vying for power, and also foreign powers who seek to expand their influence in the region by backing various different parties within the country. So from the beginning, we'll remember that in the year 2011, beginning in Egypt, there were Arab Spring protests in which disaffected youths in many Arab countries took to the streets and demanded that their dictators leave their seats and these countries become democracies. In that struggle, President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had ruled the country for 33 years, was forced to stand down in an agreement he didn't particularly like, but was shepherded by the United States and Yemen's Gulf neighbors. What followed was the election of his vice president, this man named Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi. Hadi proved to be very weak and not as adept as Saleh in managing all the various armed forces that vied for power in the country. What happened was, beginning about 7-8 months ago, this armed Shiite Muslim group in Yemen's far north started advancing closer and closer to the capital. Unlike Saleh, who had fought this group to a standstill for about a decade, Hadi seemed like he didn't know really what to do, despite him having the full backing of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and other powerful countries. He couldn't stop this group militarily. They took the capital. They kicked him out. And what seems to have happened is that this Shiite Muslim group made a marriage of convenience with ex-President Saleh, who is determined to settle scores with Hadi and all the people he thinks kicked him out.
Who sent the Houthis? Why did they come down? Was it related to U.S. drone attacks? I've read that they were upset about the drone attacks, but the drone attacks, I presumably, were not primarily on them. Why did they suddenly get up and get armed and begin marching on Sana'a and more?
The Houthis are an Islamist group, but they're an Islamist group that wants to take part in politics, and they're Shiite Islamists. What many people focus on when they look at Yemen is the threat from Sunni Islamist extremists in Al-Qaeda. And these are the type of Islamists who don't want anything to do with governments, democracy, other countries, or anything. That, you know, Al-Qaeda, on the one hand, has launched attacks against the Yemeni state and Western interests from their base in Yemen for a decade. And that's why the United States has, for the last 2 years, especially under Obama, as you mentioned, launched this covert war of drone strikes against Al-Qaeda. Now, the Houthis, in their war with the Yemeni state for the last 10 years, they've been backed, many people say, by Iran, because Iran is the primary Shiite country in the region. What seems to have eased their way into the capital is a combination of Iranian backing and the backing of forces loyal to the ex-president, Ali Abdullah Saleh.
So when people talk about a civil war, how close are we to that? How do you know in Yemen when you're in civil war and not just the usual? And if it emerges, if it emerges, is it a proxy war? Is it a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and the Iranians?
The worst case scenario we could see in Yemen is a complete breakdown of whatever remains of the Yemeni state and military, to the extent that they are not able to protect territory and keep Shiite groups like the Houthis from fighting a sectarian civil war with people like Al-Qaeda and Sunni tribes people fighting with Al-Qaeda. And in any worst-case scenario like that, it would be very difficult to see regional countries not getting involved, in the same way that we've seen that sectarian fighting in places like Iraq and Syria. We see that on the one hand, countries like Saudi Arabia and other smaller Gulf Sunni countries have backed forces fighting against Shiite fighters there who are backed by Iran. This would be the worst case scenario for Yemen, but for the last couple of years in the region, it seemed like, unfortunately, the trend that Saudi Arabia especially has been vying for hegemony over the region with Shiite Iran, and the two sides are backing different groups in various countries. That could happen in Yemen. It's in many ways already happening. All that remains to be seen is how bad it gets.
U.S. Special Forces left in a hurry over the weekend. We're reading that Al-Qaeda fighters were just 20 miles or so from the gates of their base there. What were they doing? And is them leaving a sign that they think this thing's going to blow? I mean, they're armed. They had means. We understand the embassy staff going out, but when Special Forces leave too, it makes you think it must really be headed in a bad direction.
Well, their exit is an unmitigated disaster for Obama's policy in Yemen and in the region as a whole in terms of counterterrorism. For years, President Obama had been saying that Yemen was a model about how to solve political problems within rest of Arab countries through dialogue. As we saw with the Houthi takeover, that the dialogue in Yemen that was sponsored by the United States completely failed. The policy of having a light footprint, attacking militants from the air with drones, is now in total jeopardy because there are actually no American personnel on the ground anymore. The capital is controlled by a sectarian militia group whose motto is death to America. There's more territory for Al-Qaeda to operate in these days, and it's going to be very difficult for the United States to reassert any kind of military or diplomatic presence in the country, given all these things.
Why is Yemen seen as such a potentially dangerous base for terrorism, even against distant targets in the United States mainland? Those could come from lots of places. Why has Yemen emerged as the place that gets American security officials most wound up?
Well, for various reasons, the state in Yemen has been very weak throughout its existence. Therefore, it's very difficult for the state to project the military out into some of these very remote and mountainous places in remote corners of the country. Now, Yemen is a very mountainous, large, difficult place in terms of terrain. When the state is in such a chronic condition of collapse like it is now, the armed forces there have split. They're more busy fighting each other than fighting against Al-Qaeda. And when Al-Qaeda militants, they have kind of a safe place in which to operate, in which to acquire explosives, in which they know that they're not going to be targeted by an army offensive or a drone strike, then they become closer to being able to launch the kind of attacks that they have in the past. And those included the notorious underwear bomber. They tried to send a Nigerian national to blow up explosives hidden in his underwear in Detroit. Flight in 2009, and they tried a similar plot a couple of years later. I think these things become easier for them when they don't have any pressure from the Yemeni state or from the U.S. military on them, given this chaos.
If this becomes an all-out proxy battle, Saudi Arabia versus Iran, who wins? Or does anyone?
Nobody wins. Everybody loses. The two countries lose, and most importantly, the 30 million people in Yemen lose. I mean, it's been a terrifying descent into chaos for the people of this country. On Friday, there was a double suicide bombing in two mosques in the capital, Sana'a, which killed over 137 people. These are things that didn't used to happen in Yemen before. I mean, they rarely even happened in full-blown war scenarios in Iraq. That the citizens of this country are shocked and ashamed about how bad things have become. And I don't think a breakdown security in this country would really even serve the interests of Saudi Arabia or Iran. I think the only reason that they would be feeling compelled to get involved is to deny the other any kind of advantage. And I think everybody loses with that kind of thinking.
And what about U.S. means now, Noah? Can the drone operators still sit with their joysticks in, I don't know, Virginia or Arizona and be effective over in the skies of Yemen?
Well, first of all, even when there was a functioning government in Yemen, this was a deeply unpopular policy among Yemenis writ large. The thing is that the government of Yemen, both under former President Saleh and current President Hadi, considered themselves very close to the United States, and they wanted to safeguard U.S. backing for their regimes by endorsing this drone program. Many analysts and critics have said that even the best of days, when there was a functioning government in Yemen, the drone program really only antagonized people who were kind of on the brink in remote areas that could be susceptible to radicalization, and didn't actually mitigate the things leading to people joining al-Qaeda, like poverty and disgruntlement with the government. That aside, it's very difficult to see how the United States would be able to man a joystick and target any...
At this point, Noah Browning with Reuters in Dubai, you're terrific. Thank you very much for being with us. We're looking at Yemen, the lessons of Yemen. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the U.S. withdrawal from Yemen, a country on the brink and a major counterterrorism center now lost to U.S. forces. Embassy evacuated. Over the weekend, U.S. Special Forces 100-plus out in a hurry. Here's a video recorded. This was just last Friday during Friday prayers at a mosque in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, Shiite mosque there. It's not exactly Garden of Eden to begin with. You hear the congregation, they're on their feet in this video, chanting, "Death to America, death to Israel," and then the sound of a suicide bomber detonating a device. It was claimed later by an Islamic State-related group. A really terrible, terrible scene. Last September, President Obama was on television outlining a four-part plan to defeat ISIS, the Islamic State. To prove his administration had the right policy, he pointed to Yemen as a key success in the light footprint approach to counterterror.
This strategy of taking out terrorists who threaten us while supporting partners on the front lines is one that we have successfully pursued in Yemen and Somalia for years. And it is consistent with the approach I outlined earlier this year, to use force against anyone who threatens America's core interests, but to mobilize partners wherever possible to address broader challenges to international order.
Okay, that was the model. Here last Thursday, the sound of gunfire in Sana'a. Yemen's capitalist Houthi fighters and government forces fought neighborhood by neighborhood for control. And here, speaking to the UN Security Council via video link on Sunday, UN Special Advisor Jamal Ben Ammar urging diplomatic action soon, warning of a country on the edge of civil war.
Emotions are running extremely high. And unless a solution can be found in the coming days, the country will slide into further violent conflict and fragmentation.
We're looking at the lessons of Yemen in a region that sees plenty of trouble right now. With us from Washington, John Alterman, Senior Vice President at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He holds the Zbigniew Brzezinski Chair in Global Security Geostrategy, directs the Middle East program there, just back from 2 weeks in the region. John Alterman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
And with us from Chicago, Tom Makaitis, terrorism expert, professor of history at DePaul University, editor at the journal Small Wars and Insurgencies, author of Iraq and the Challenge of Counterinsurgency. Tom Makaitis, thank you for being with us.
Hello.
What's the lesson for American counterterrorism policy and what we've just seen come down in Yemen, Tom?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't agree with Noah. It's a good description of the conditions in Yemen, but this is a setback. It's not a huge strategic defeat. And no one who's criticizing the approach we're taking is really offering a viable option. The only alternative that they could come up with is some sort of massive intervention. And I would remind everyone that there was no ISIS until we invaded Iraq, that we essentially created the conditions that, in fact, have produced a lot of this instability. Now, we didn't create the Arab Spring, but we keep forgetting, we keep focusing on this as our problem. These are overwhelmingly local conflicts driven by local issues, and we don't want to turn them into overwhelmingly ours. And as much as al-Qaeda in Iraq, or excuse me, in Yemen is a serious problem, they've mounted two rather, you know, unsophisticated attacks against us over the last decade.
You mean the underwear bomber and the fake computer,
the
printer?
Yeah, the printer toner cartridge things. Yeah. And we interdicted them both. They're a concern. But the issue is, let's not exaggerate this. And it's not the case that, you know, that we are incapable of projecting force if we need to. What the drone strikes were about were degrading leadership capability. And we took the leader out. They're not a panacea. They're not perfect. It is a setback to lose the human intelligence of the special forces on the ground and their training capability. But it is not an unmitigated disaster.
Well, look, we're not holding this up and saying this didn't work, so let's go back to big war. As you say,
right,
we can all see what the consequences of that were. On
yeah.
the other hand, Tom, this has been held out as the model for how the light footprint works. Look at Libya,
yep.
light footprint, the aftermath not so good there, and it wasn't so light. Here, light, and it was pointed to as this is the way. I mean, listen to just for a second here. This is former U.S.
Yeah.
Ambassador to Yemen, Barbara Bodine. She's talking with NPR's Morning Edition today, saying, I mean, she's been there. She was our ambassador there. She says she's got real concerns about this pullout.
It may be the rational thing to do in terms of the security of our people. But right now we have no one on the ground in Yemen in any capacity. And that puts us at an enormous disadvantage in trying to figure out what is going on.
Tom Makaitis, okay, you say not an unmitigated
yeah.
disaster, we can come back, but this is hardly terrific proving out of this policy.
No,
and look at the forces converging in Yemen. It looks
yeah,
so volatile.
No question. Yeah, and I think, no, I'm not denying that. I mean, the fact is, what's really unfortunate is the rhetoric holding any place up that is so fragile and saying this is a sterling example was an unfortunate thing to do.
On President Obama's part, you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. No question. It's actually a political disaster.
Yeah, but he did that for a reason. He did that when ISIS was rolling over all over the place, and he needed to say to the American people, this is not out of control. We've got a handle on this. It turns out
yeah.
we don't.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true either. ISIS is expanding in certain areas. But again, I think we've got ISIS on the brain in this country. The fact that Boko Haram has now sworn allegiance to al-Baghdadi and said, oh, he's now the great caliph, that there's forces in Libya that are saying, swearing allegiance to it as well, doesn't change the fact that these are local conflicts and that they are latching onto an ideology. But that the idea that there – and by the way, we are having some success in Iraq, particularly with the Kurdish forces rolling back ISIS, which I think is going to fail simply because it's so incredibly brutal to its own people. And as I think Noah pointed out so well, I wrote about Yemen when it was – not even Yemen, when it was South Arabia, the southern part of it, in Aden. It has always been a fragile state where the capital areas and the cities have never controlled the interior of the country. So we're not talking about a sea change in that regard. It's worrisome given the number of people. Anytime you have a fragile or failed state, you have the ability of these nefarious forces. Look at al-Shabaab in Somalia. But then again, al-Shabaab's ability to do much damage outside the region has been relatively limited. So I'm not denying this is a failure. I'm not denying it's a serious concern. I just don't want it blown into some sort of enormous, you know, catastrophe that's going to threaten our security.
John Alterman, jump in here. The description that Tom Mikaitis is sharing with us from Chicago will line up quite well with a lot of comments we're seeing from listeners online as we speak. I mean, here's Sean says, let the Arabs figure it out. Daphne says, let them kill themselves. We should sit back and let them settle this. Tom says these are local problems. It's not a major security threat. Is that right, John? Can we have a sense of equanimity about this? Let the fire burn?
Well, let me tell you why I'm a little uncomfortable with that, and that is Yemen is emerging as very quickly the principal proxy war between Iran and some of the GCC states. Out of that proxy war, you not only have the death and destruction that comes from it, but the radicalization that spins out of it.
And you're talking Iran versus Saudi Arabia and its mates there, the Sunni bunch. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yep.
And my concern is when you have all these proxy wars, and you currently have proxy wars probably going on in about four different places in the Arab world right now, that creates its own dynamic. That creates its own cycle of radicalization, and you begin to feed this new phenomenon of the Islamic State that Tom was describing. I'm a little less confident that this is all going to remain localized, that it won't affect others. We certainly saw the effects on certainly French politics of the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
Yep.
It worries me that as these fires continue to burn, as this escalates, that it won't remain contained, that it not only will affect U.S. allies in the region, U.S. interests in the region, but it'll start to affect the United States as well. Certainly not going to take down the government of the United States. Nobody's going to be on American shores. But we've seen the profound effects on our politics, on security, on our economy of the 9/11 attacks. And while I'm not predicting the 9/11 attacks again, I certainly think that the idea that this can all just stay far away and will have no effect on us, I think is probably an incorrect assessment.
Let's hear, if I may, just for a moment here. It's political in a hurry over the weekend. Many Republicans were quick to say, you know, a foreign policy disaster, to your point, Tom Mikaitis in Chicago. Here's the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Texas Republican Michael McCaul, talking with ABC's This Week, saying, hey, this withdrawal of special forces, big problem.
Because we are withdrawing completely, we will have no intelligence footprint or capabilities to monitor what AQAP and ISIS and the Shia militants are doing in the region. And without, you know, good intelligence stops plots against the homeland. Without that intelligence, we cannot effectively stop it. That's what I'm most concerned about.
That's where his concern lies. Tom Mikaitis, if this goes to proxy war, if it goes deeper in that direction, and that, look, it's shaping up over the region now. You've got Iranians in the middle of Iraq fighting, you know, the Shiite Iranians fighting the Sunni Islamic State. If that gets extended down here to Yemen and Saudi Arabia gets all up in arms about it, where does that go?
First of all, I never said we should approach it with equanimity, nor that it wasn't a cause for concern. I'm simply saying that these are conflicts that to some degree we have to manage. We can strengthen our allies in the region. We can work with them. But I still haven't heard a viable alternative as to what we realistically could have done to prop up a basically dysfunctional Yemeni government and prevent this. It is a proxy war, but that's only one dimensional. That's one thing. That, yes, the Iranians and the Saudis are in fact, you know, positioning and sparring with one another through these things. But that does not explain the whole dynamic of this. And the question is that where, you know, what are we to do? If we send troops in here to contain, how do we then deal with Syria? What do we do about Libya? I think the bottom line is that we just basically can only work with our allies and provide backstop and support. And I'm, by the way, not persuaded that we have nobody left in Yemen. I mean, special forces are not in the habit of broadcasting what they're doing. We've pulled out 100 special forces advisors out of an airbase. That doesn't mean we have no eyes on the ground. The other thing you mentioned, well, look, it comes back. Look what it did in the case of France. France's problems have a lot more to do with French racism and a ghettoized Muslim population. Look at Chicago. Look at my own city of Chicago. Look at your city of Boston. Do you have a massive Muslim ghetto where people live in a disadvantaged environment?
No, we do
they're
not.
Integrated. Mm-hmm. That's the point. And look, we don't have That we have some radicalization, mostly disgruntled young people, but we don't have that dynamic. So even that has a profoundly local dimension. I'm not pie in the sky about this. I'm not saying we shouldn't do anything. I'm saying we should be very, very careful because there's a lot of evidence that when we go in guns blazing, we make things worse.
Look, Tom Akitis in Chicago, I think Americans are well, maybe not everybody, but from what I can see from our listeners, they're kind of over the light versus heavy argument. They would love to do the light argument. Who wants to? Heavy, you know, we've seen all the problems with that.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're so necessarily persuaded that that what happens out there can just, you know, go its way. I mean, you say it won't go proxy, but here we are.
No, I didn't say that. Well, no, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying we should do nothing. I'm saying we remain engaged. We try to get back in. We do, if we can continue to work with their what's left of their army, we do that. We still have intelligence assets in the region. We still have special forces. We still have drone capability. We have a setback here in that we don't have eyes on the ground to the degree that we did. I'm saying we definitely remain engaged. We're discussing how we actually do this. And the bottom line is you can't. You know, speaking of my work on counterinsurgency, you can't win the hearts and minds of somebody else's people when their own government can't do it. And the issue is that's really the key here. We can only do so much here, and that's what the critics of the president. And I'm not saying that he's an unmitigated success with this. There have been a lot of setbacks, but I still think that the approach is the correct one because I don't really see a viable alternative.
Stand by. Tom Akitis in Chicago, John Alterman in Washington. Joe is calling from Marfa, Texas. Joe, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi. I was at 911, and by the grace of God, I was not in the actual building. I had a diversion to go to a shop.
Yeah.
Look, I saw people jumping from a building. Right. Let's remember
that
counterterrorism is to prevent people, Americans, dying. That includes American soldiers. This is a religious war that will last forever because Sunnis and Shiites are arguing over who the correct Christ was.
So what's the correct path for the U.S., Joe?
The correct path is to not be naive enough to think that there aren't people there and that the policy that this current government has provided for the last 6 years, which is to disengage but watch and take action, has worked. So this may be a great story to talk about, and it certainly is important, but this is a religious war, and we're trying to make sure that people who are going to hurt the United States are taken out.
Joe, we've got it. John Alterman. You hear Joe's perspective, and I hear a little tension in there because he doesn't want another 9/11, yet that relies in some part on counterterrorism efforts. There's been a lot of energy put into that, Lord knows. So on the other hand, you know, he says this light way has worked, but here we've pulled out, so we haven't been able to sustain it in Yemen, at least right now. I think the thing that has people worried is, the reason we're talking about it, is that the whole region seems to be becoming more volatile as we move forward, John, which makes it patience or, you know, equanimity more. And I'm not saying, Tom, that you don't care, but it makes it harder to just say, let's just keep working on it because it's ramping up, John, not down.
You do. And Tom's absolutely right. You have to pick your battles. I think one of the things that we haven't really talked about, which is very important based on all the diplomats I've spoken to who have worked in Yemen for the last 15 years or so, is that in many ways our entire strategy toward Yemen was a counterterrorism strategy. Mm-hmm. It was led by the terrorist threat. When there was a terrorist threat in Yemen, the U.S. was more engaged with the Yemeni government. When there was less of a terrorist threat, the U.S. had less to do with the Yemeni government. We had this campaign of drones from the air, which many people in Yemen and elsewhere think doesn't really begin to solve the underlying problems. And what we've had, as Tom correctly pointed out, is rather than diminishing the terrorist threat, we've seen the terrorist threat increase. I'm not sure I agree with Joe that this is simply a religious conflict. Sunnis and Shia traditionally in Yemen have gotten along. They pray together. There are longstanding connections, and theologically, the Zaydi Shia in North Yemen have a lot to do with Sunnis and not a lot to do with the Twelver Shia in Iran and other parts of the region.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the U.S. withdrawal from Yemen. First, embassy staff over this weekend, U.S. Special Forces out and out, looking at a country on the brink by many assessments, and a major counterterrorism center, at least for now, lost to U.S. forces. John Alterman is with us from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Tom Mikaitis is with us from DePaul University in Chicago, editor of the journal Small Wars and Insurgencies. He's paid a lot of attention, they both have here. In January, President Obama had to admit that his strategy in Yemen wasn't working out quite as well as he had hoped or indicated earlier. Here he is at a press conference. This is January 25th, joint press conference with India's Prime Minister Modi, saying the U.S. would stick with its Yemen policy, but that it's a work in progress.
We'll continue to try to refine and fine-tune this model, but it is the model that we're going to have to work with because the alternative would be massive U.S. deployments in perpetuity, which would create its own blowback and cause probably more problems than it would potentially solve.
Massive U.S. deployments in perpetuity doesn't sound so good to much of anybody these days. On the other hand, here was former ambassador to Yemen, U.S. Ambassador Barbara Bodine. Bill Clinton put her in there. She was there from 97 to 2001, talking with NPR's Morning Edition today, saying that the drone way, the way that this president has pushed so hard to go lighter with, is hard to do when you're not on the ground, and we're not now.
You can't really do the kind of counterterrorism operations that we've been doing without somebody on the ground. Drones need intelligence behind them.
Meanwhile, in Yemen, it's pretty much a mess. Here's a BBC News report on the deteriorating situation in the port of city of Aden, down on the southern coast, the President Hadi's power base.
At the other end of the country, the port city of Aden, Mr. Hadi's bolt hole and now his power base. There were more protests here too this week. This is a chaotic fight for territory, power and superiority, broadly splitting the country in two, a violent north-south divide.
Okay, John Alterman, Tom Mikaitis, again, lots of response here. Rajesh says on Twitter, let the Kuwaitis and Saudis, who are largely responsible for this, Rajesh says, deal with Islamic State. Enough is enough. Let's not be helicopter parents. Josh says, I'm sure we have a few amphibious assault ships in the Gulf of Aden. We will come and go as we please. But how effective, I don't know. Sam says the one thing the U.S. does have is pure arrogance when it comes to other cultures. We can't change ideology with bombs, period. And here's another listener who wants us to remember, to your point, Tom Mikaitis, that the so-called underwear bomber over Detroit, it's not as though he was intercepted. He was on the plane and failed to pull it off. So there we are. Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is really that how are we going to continue justifying the drone program in this country when, in the long run, it doesn't seem – well, we whittle down a leadership here and there. In the long run, it seems to be aggravating more people, and I think that's actually a major part of where some of these recruitments are coming from, are these disenfranchised, aggravated cultures who are tired of our continued presence.
Tom Mikaitis?
Yeah. John said something right before the break that I want to pick up on that's absolutely spot on for this whole issue, and that is there's a profound flaw in the whole notion of a counterterrorism strategy because you're focused far too much on degrading the network by killing people. I think what we need here and what we should – the one criticism I would level is that more of a counterinsurgency strategy where exactly as John indicated and as the speaker did, you try to address the root causes. Now, that doesn't mean the drones and targeted killings of that kind don't have a role. It means they should not be the focus of what you're doing. But again, we come back to a bit of a conundrum. The only way that you can do that. And by the way, there's a great example of this. It was flawed, but at the end it did work in El Salvador. But it only worked with a very small U.S. footprint when we pursued persuaded that government that it had to stop its human rights violations, et cetera. And then you actually did get a negotiated settlement. That was a simpler situation compared to this. But my point is this whole notion of counterterrorism focusing on killing people, drones or otherwise, is not really going to be effective. It can be a tool, but when it becomes a strategy, it could be a tactic. When it comes to strategy, I think we've got a problem.
But John Alterman, a reference to El Salvador somehow seems so quaint in this context. It appears from outside that you have, call them what you will, insurgents, terrorists, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, who are only too happy to work at these seams of sectarian conflict and hope to get them to explode because that creates openings. I mean, this isn't just a human rights issue. This seems like a grand, you know, battle royale here. And they're happy to have sectarian uproar around.
It is a cage fight, and certainly the Iranians are opposed to both al-Qaeda and opposed to the Islamic State. The Houthis were adamantly opposed to the Islamic State. The southern government is opposed to the Islamic State. So everybody seems, all the governments seem aligned. There may be some people in the Gulf states who think it's useful to have the Islamic State because that creates a problem for the Houthis and for the Iranians. The Iranians have certainly had some tactical cooperation with al-Qaeda because it creates trouble for others. This is ultimately really about an Arab-Persian conflict manifested in another place. I remember talking to a prince in the Gulf about Sunni-Shia tensions, and he looked at me like I was a child and nodded his head and smiled kindly and said, "You don't understand. The Iranians have only been Shia for 500 years, and they've been Persians for millennia. And the more that that logic goes in, that we're just going to do anything to weaken these guys, and it doesn't matter if there's chaos and we'll take down another government, that whole thing will create a dynamic." Ultimately, I think what that means from our perspective is, as Tom correctly points out, your strategy can't be drone attacks. Your strategy has to be somehow working the diplomacy to change the preferences so that you begin to change the external actors and you begin to change the internal actors and begin to change the logic of this conflict.
But you look at diplomacy, John, the UN Security Council talking over the weekend, and I've seen plenty of ineffectual UN actions, but I don't remember one that seemed quite so disconnected from reality on the ground. I mean, they can say whatever they want sitting in New York. It just doesn't seem to have any traction here in Yemen.
Right now, it doesn't. I think when people are feeling more pain, it will have a different perspective. Mm-hmm. It may be that we're just not at the necessary pain point in this conflict.
Let's go to John in Lexington, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
My question has to do with Iran and some of the comments coming out now from the Iranian negotiators. They're saying we are gaining influence throughout the Middle East. Why do we really want to conclude this nuclear agreement? We win either way. Just wanted to get your thoughts, particularly from Tom.
No, but John, where are you going with that? We win either way, meaning what, John? Just clarify if you would.
Meaning the Iranians don't really sincerely want to conclude this nuclear agreement because they're gaining influence in the Middle East.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I mean, I think what the reason they want the agreement is because they're suffering from the economic sanctions. That's a bit of a tangent to what we're talking about. I think the real instability, ironically, is we always had Iraq to balance Iran, and that lever has gone. We can't fix that. But
we took it out.
Yeah, we did. But the law of unintended consequences. I don't really see how the Iranian nuclear deal fits terribly well into this conversation.
Well, let me push that, if I may.
Sure. Okay.
Because if John's right, if we have an incipient, and that may be a kind word for it, it doesn't look so incipient these days, Persian-Arab conflict unfolding here, with Iran kind of feeling its oats and Saudi Arabia not ready to give, and the others, the GCC. And now we've got a new battleground, perhaps, a proxy battleground in Yemen. We've got another to the north of Saudi Arabia, where you've got Iranians deep in Iraq now prosecuting the war against the Islamic State. Doesn't the nuclear question come in here in a hurry? If Iran appears to be making further progress and some kind of bigger conflict appears to be inexorably mounting here, doesn't that put pressure on the rest of the Sunni Arabs to also go for the nuclear button?
I'd be happy to defer to John on that one since he's got the regional expertise, but I don't see any likelihood that any of the Arab states are even close to requiring a bomb.
John, if Iran is seen to be on the path to having one?
I was talking to a foreign minister in the Gulf 2 weeks ago, and he told me if anybody tells you that if the Iranians don't acquire a weapon, the other Arab states will, isn't true, they're lying to you. I think there certainly will be interest, but I think it's important that to follow up on John's point, a lot of this is marketing, and it's the Iranians trying to shape the perception of where they are. But there's no question that the Iranians are feeling pressure. It's no question that the Arab states are also feeling the Iranians are on the roll. A lot of this is just about negotiating strategy and tactics. I think the Iranians are feeling vulnerable, and therefore they'll want to make a deal. But because they're feeling vulnerable, they won't want to make the deal because they think they'll lock in their current position of weakness.
Do you mean that even what we see in Yemen is part of negotiations in Geneva?
Sure. And it's all about, you know, Iran feels vulnerable. Iran feels they're surrounded by hostile states. They feel that their economy is being kept down, that Iran is not able to exercise its proper power in the Middle East. And as a consequence, they are trying to do everything they can to enhance their position. One of the things we've always seen the Iranians do is just before negotiations start or just before negotiations are concluded, rather than being on good behavior, they actually are on bad behavior with the idea that then they have more to give away in the actual negotiation.
I want to be sure I understand what you're saying. So it is possible, even likely in your view, that the gunfire and chaos we see in Yemen right now is in some dimension Iran talking to U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry at the nuclear negotiations in Geneva.
For more than 6 months, there has been a concerted Iranian effort to assert to Americans that there are a whole range of things where Iran can play a helpful role to U.S. policy, but first we have to get by this nuclear issue. And it was true when President Rouhani came to New York in September, and it's been repeated since. And the president sent a letter to Rouhani back in November that suggested, yeah, we have some common interests.
But talk about a devil's choice, then. If that means give us some running room for our nuclear weapons program in Geneva, or we'll give you trouble in Yemen. I mean, and then you say, John, that your foreign minister in the region says, well, of course, if Iran gets a weapon, we'll all go for weapons. Which way does the U.S. go?
The Arab states say, look, Iran is on a roll, and what the U.S. is going to do is it's going to cede power to the Iranians at our expense in order to serve its own needs, in order to serve Israeli security needs, whatever. The whole problem is that nobody in here trusts anybody. And what you're seeing in Yemen is a manifestation of this broader sense of a Cold War in the region and a willingness to engage in a Cold War. What happens then in all of these proxy wars, and you're seeing a lot of them, is that the Islamic State takes root in government dysfunction, the inability to deliver services, and the whole thing blows apart.
And yet we're going to have some kind of policy here, hands on, hands off, something. Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Europe had ruinous religious warfare for several hundred years. They don't have that anymore. Nobody made them stop. Nobody rode in from Asia or Africa and made Europe stop that foolishness. The kind of region-wide dysfunction that exists in the Middle East between Persians and Arabs, Kurds and Turks, Shiite and Sunni, there's nothing the United States or anyone else can do from half a world away to stop this thing. We can have these little tactical victories. We can approach this piecemeal until that kind of thing changes, and it's going to take generations, apparently. It might take 500 years. But until that kind of hatred and internecine squabbling stops, this is a fool's errand we're on, because we could clean this mess up completely in over the course of the next year, but only a fool would think that we fixed the problem.
Kevin, I've got it. I really do. On the other hand, it's a small world these days, and you know the kind of criticism that's coming down here. Here again is the Republican chair of the House Homeland Security Committee, Michael McCaul, Texas, saying, look what's happening if the U.S. isn't in there. Here's McCaul.
We pulled out of Libya. Now look what's happened, a safe haven, a vacuum, ISIS training militants to hit in Tunisia, and now we got Yemen. All of northern Africa seems to be falling to this power vacuum that is being filled by the terrorists.
John Alterman, we've got a minute for each of you here. What's the way?
the strange thing about all of these wars is in many cases we have at least one ally fighting the war, sometimes two of our allies, like in Libya, we have allies on both sides fighting this war. I agree that we can't solve all of the problems. We may be able to play some role mitigating them, mm-hmm. and it's very much in our interest if we can to do so.
Tom Mikaitis?
I'm making a list in my head of all the critics of the president. We should send troops to Tunisia, to Libya, to Syria, Iraq, to Yemen. It's not doable. I think John's absolutely right. We can contain, we can manage, we can try and involve. I think these conflicts in Tunisia, Libya would have happened anyway. They're a consequence of the Arab Spring. So I think we keep on keeping on, and this is a setback. It's not an unmitigated disaster.
Do you think we'll be back in Yemen soon, guiding drone strikes, or is that a bad idea?
Well, what does back mean? I'm not sure.
Well, we were there with 100-plus special forces and an embassy. How about that?
Yeah, that we know of. I'm not sure. I'm not convinced that everybody, every special forces person is completely out. The ones we know about that we're training are out. We will be back. It's a question of when and to what degree.
And a big blow-up coming out of Yemen? What are the odds of that, of this becoming part of something bigger and worse?
I think it already is part of something larger, as John articulated so well. But the issue is we're right back to what exactly do we do about it. To some degree, we can try to play with the rational actors, but it's there's no easy fix.
Fine-tuning.
Pretty much.
Tom Mikaitis at DePaul University in Chicago, editor of the journal Small Wars and Insurgencies. Who knows what size this is going to be. Tom, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And John Alterman, Senior Vice President at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joining us today from Washington. John, thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Or follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow in this hour, we are asking kind of a big question. Is America now its own worst enemy with its own internal divisions, blowing a future that could be good? Harvard's Joseph Nye joins us. The New Yorker's John Cassidy will be here. Hope you will be too. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.